At the end of his address, which lasted 1 hour, Professor Robert Carr opened the floor to questions. Each had to be handwritten and handed to Ralph Bloom, who was moderating the symposium. I was able to get 3 questions answered. The first dealt with Carr. Did he see the flying saucer, which he claims crashed in northwestern New Mexico in 1948?
I didn't get up to Farmington until it had been removed. However, the population of Farmington has not calmed down yet. And I have seen on 2 occasions, along with 5 million other Americans, I have seen saucer-shaped disks at high altitudes passing from cloud to cloud that were metallic mechanical constructions. I have never been in the hangar at Wright Field because an innocuous non-entity of a little college professor like me could not possibly have the exalted security clearance necessary to go in. However, people with exalted security clearances do retire, and they do get mellow, and they do talk.
Professor Carr, on October 14th, you mentioned 2 flying saucers. What about the second one?
The second disc was found 2 weeks later, 200 miles south of Farmington, New Mexico. It was spotted by an air patrol, and when they landed, they found it was an old wreck. The disc was half burned, and there were some charred, decayed, partly mummified bodies in there. It was of little scientific or biological use. It was, however, removed and is being kept at Wright-Patterson Field. It's the second one, not nearly as interesting as the perfect one. Next.
Are there any other craft in captivity?
There was a crash in Mexico, and investigators tried very hard find what became of the material evidence. And apparently the CIA was so well organized in Mexico that they were able to remove the entire evidence from the state of Mexico to somewhere other than Wright-Patterson Field. Wright-Patterson Field is a sort of a cover for the second-rate stuff. The really first-rate stuff is somewhere in Virginia at a location that even I have never been able to pinpoint.
My third question asked Dr. Carr, where did these saucers come from? He responded by saying,
That's the first question that President Eisenhower asked when he flew to Edwards Air Force Base and put his hand on the captured UFO. He asked the assembled generals and scientists, where do they come from? Not one had an idea. I have asked 3 astronomers and 4 astrophysicists the same question. This is the consensus, and it is also the consensus in the excellent selection of books out in the lobby, that the UFOs come from outside our solar system. There is no planet in our solar system rich enough to support the magnificence series of civilizations which is manufacturing and manning these craft and sending them. And interstellar distances would pose no difficulty to craft that could travel at 95% of the speed of light.
In conclusion, Professor Robert Carr repeated what he said on October 14th. The Air Force is not telling the truth about flying saucers. It does, said Carr, have 2 saucers and 12 preserved bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Refusing to name names of those who fed him information about what is allegedly hidden in Building 18, Professor Carr cited 3 sources. First, a high-ranking Air Force officer, who he says was aboard the cargo plane that brought the craft back from Edwards Air Force Base. A security guard at Wright-Patt. And third, a biologist. According to Carr,
he spent every winter in Florida, and it was an ongoing thing. He even had in his possession the biological section of the general report, which had been torn from the much larger report. It was all ragged on the edge. Then there was the security guard who was on duty at Wright-Patterson Field for some years. And for some months of that time, he was the head of the security detail on the hangar, which concealed the evidence. And by opening and shutting the door to admit groups of civilian scientists and medical men, he, as the man who had the key, had ample opportunity to look inside. And after he retired and was a civilian and realized that he had participated in history-making events and that no national security considerations were available, he mellowed up a little bit and talked and told what he had seen. His sister is now trying to sell some snapshots he took.
Carr and the sponsor of the Flying Saucer Symposium in Tampa, Florida, refused to give me the name of either the guard or his sister. But Professor Carr made the mistake of telling a San Francisco news service the name of his source, who lives in Canada. Thanks to a radio station in Ottawa and a student at Georgetown University here in Washington, I was able to trace Arthur Bray. Two nights ago, I asked him if he was the security guard Professor Carr quotes as a primary source for the flying saucer story at Wright-Patt.
I did not serve at Wright-Patterson Field. I have no first-hand knowledge of the subject. So I don't know whether I can be of any help.
Dr. Carr, his statement is not accurate then.
That is correct.
Do you have any knowledge of what he's talking about?
Oh, yes, I do. I have seen the recent news reports on this subject and Carr's statements concerning the matter. And certainly the subject is not new. I've been well aware of the particular matter since back in 1951 when it was published in a book by Frank Scully. So, as I say, it's nothing new. The subject has been resurrected, so to speak. Now, whether the matter is factual or not, I have no way of knowing.
We ran into the same brick wall when we came into information a few weeks ago from John Getter, a television reporter for Avco Broadcasting in Cincinnati. 3 years ago, a personal friend told him in strictest confidence she had helped classify a flying saucer and several dead crewmen while serving as the executive secretary to the officer in charge of security at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The incident reportedly occurred in the late 1960s during the waning days of Blue Book, the official Air Force investigation of unidentified flying objects. When we sent Getter back to visit his old friend on the night of October 16th, she refused to repeat what she had told him earlier.
She has been told, she says, that if she even discusses matters which came across her desk when she was in the employ of the Air Force, that she can lose her, to begin with, she will lose her pension and so on and so forth, and after that they could end up prosecuting her.
Did she give you any indication off the record as to the validity of what she said?
I asked her if she could tell me if we were on the right track with the reports of the bodies and so on and so forth out there. And she said, well, I can't even really say. But and I remember her words here. She said, I can't really say, but I'd be very interested to know what you find out from other people.
Pressed further about his interview, John Getter said,
the impression I got from the tone of voice and everything else was we're obviously on the right track, but she is afraid to say so because she didn't want to get herself in the ringer for being the one to say, yes, they are there.
In his new book entitled Beyond Earth, Man's Contact with UFOs, Ralph Bloom cites a turning point in history of UFO investigations. In 1953, Bloom says Air Force Regulation 200-2 went into effect. It stipulated that the percentage of unidentifieds must be reduced to a minimum. Air Force 200-2 was tied in with another regulation, JNAP 146, which made release of any information regarding unidentifieds by military personnel a crime punishable by a fine of $10,000 and up to 10 years in prison. Bloom writes on page 102 of his book, the fact that JNAP 146 is still in effect could explain the lack of enthusiasm you may encounter if you telephone your local Air Force base and tell them what has just landed next to your house.